the Transverse Network, this is The Transgender Show, an interview program about self-acceptance and discovery. I'm your host, Emily. This week on the show is Toni Leslie, a Native American transgender female writer and artist from upstate New York. Her many past jobs include professional photographer, contractor, pilot, radio station DJ, and photo collage artist. Toni is currently working as a peer recovery coach in addiction and is working on a memoir describing her life and transition. Everyone, welcome to the show, Toni.
Hi, Emily.
Let's go ahead and hop into the show. I'm having a good time just interacting with chat, so... As we start to try and refocus and actually get into the show, let's start with my favorite one and the easiest question we have of the night. How did you choose your name?
The easiest way to say it is my birth name was Anthony. My parents named me Anthony, but I hated it then, and I still do. I didn't know why I hated it so much back then, but when my mother used to call me Anthony from the other room, it was just like sandpaper on the ears. And so as soon as I could, when I left the house, I changed it to Toni with a Y. And I guess it's kind of a cop out to be Toni with an I. It just seems too easy. But it was also, I didn't have to reintroduce myself to everybody I knew. And I could still be Toni with an I. And my wife at a restaurant, we were down in Cracker Barrel restaurant, and you could actually order your stuff electronically at the table. And so she happened to notice that I wrote Toni with an I. It was the first time I'd ever written it that way. And she looked at me eyeball to eyeball, and she said, "Is there something that I need to know?" And I sat there and I said, "Nope." not that I know of. And I essentially did one of many basically lies of omission. I didn't know how to talk about it, so I didn't talk about anything. So Toni with an I was, that's the first time I said it out loud. And then Leslie is my middle name, so I figured sometime in the future, if I need to do a legal change, I at least won't have to change that one. So it's not any more complicated than that. That part of my story is easy.
Do you have another name that you've been considering or trying out, or are you happy with the I at the end of your name for feminization?
Actually, Jessica, but that's already been taken. So no, I'm good with Toni with an I, although it might end up being that I'm in touch with Jennifer Boylan, who wrote the book. She's not there, which I might refer to later. She and I have been actually connected at one point. We exchanged emails and I had said that I was thinking about it, you know, using Leslie instead of Toni. Mm. And she said, "I think Leslie is a fine name." So it might be that I've become Leslie, but, you know, that's part of transition. You don't know from moment to moment where it's going to all go.
Yeah. And that's the fun of it, right? You can change. That's the best part that we try and really talk about here on the Transgender Show, is that your transition doesn't have to be something static. It doesn't have to be point A to point B. And once you get here, you're done. You can meander and go all over the whole time and, you know, try things, figure things out, and, you know, you can use a name for 2 years and then go, you know what, this just is not it, and change it to something else. I just want to make sure that people know that, yeah, that's something you can totally change. And I'm sure if you wanted to, you can contact Jessica and be like, "Hey, can I get your blessing?" And I'm sure she'd be like, "Yeah, join the Jess ranks. We can have the more the merrier."
Yeah, we were actually talking about that earlier today, that I literally know 10 Jessicas. She's the only one who spells it with a K, but I mean, there's a lot of Jessicas. I don't know why that's so, but it turns out to be true.
That was something I found out after choosing Emily for my name, is that apparently there are a ton of trans Emilys out there. So, you know, hey, whatever.
You're actually the only Emily that I know.
Well, there you go. So I did well, at least in your circle. As long as I hang out in your circle, I can be the Emily.
Yeah, the Emily with, and for some reason I have such a hard time remembering the name. I don't know why.
So you had that moment at the restaurant where you played around and put the I for your name and then weren't able to explain it to your wife. That was a struggle for you. When did you realize that you were trans, that, you know, the full weight of that, you know, when was your egg cracked and you realized that, oh, I am trans?
Well, my story kind of breaks down into three, you know, time periods, because I knew something was up when I was 5 years old, and by 11, I was drinking alcoholically. In fact, there were three things in my closet that I had, well, two things anyway, that I had hidden in the back. One of them was a bottle of my father's gin, at 11, and the other one was a bag of my mother's clothes that I had stolen from the hamper, and I was using one to cover up the other. And back then in the 70s, we didn't have words for what I was feeling. And if I were to voice some of what I was feeling, I probably would have been laughed at. I know my parents used to call me weirdo, and some people called me a lot worse. And I learned at an early age to sort of bury it. And so for years and years and years, I did, I knew something was up, but I didn't know what it was specifically. And then college, my first experience with it was in photography. I began to experiment with photographs of myself. And the first one I did was a Farrah Fawcett photograph. It was a poster, and I photographed it, and then I morphed my face onto her hair. That was the first time I ever saw myself as a woman. It began a series of transgender, well, we weren't even calling it transgender. It was like drag queen photographs, and I was my own subject. And I did my senior thesis in college as a photographer, or a photo major. I did all, you know, drag queen photography. Hmm. I was at the first Wigstock. I was at all of the Wigstocks until they got really commercial, and it was hard to get in. And I did a lot of collages of Wigstocks and myself, and on and on. And there was at one point I remember dressing up in front of the camera. And I had just done my makeup, and I had put on the right wig, and I got the camera set up, and everything was just perfect. And I looked at myself in the mirror, and I started to cry. I was overcome with emotion, and I said out loud to my reflection, "There you are. Like, where have you been my whole life?" But that was a moment, see, and then I tried to cover that up with whatever. So the actual egg cracking was my therapist. I showed her some of those earlier photos because she begged me to show her some of my artwork. At one point, she wanted to see what I was up to. So I dug out some of those photos. I think I sent you one of them when you wanted some photography. And they were pretty racy, and I said, you know, that was when I was a man trying to pretend to be a woman. And she said to me one day, maybe you've always been a woman and you're trying to pretend to be a man. And you know, that hit me like, you know, a truck, you know, and it took all the air out of my sails, and my lungs almost couldn't breathe. And I said, no, that's not it. It's gotta be something else. And let's go back to talking about my father. I don't want to talk about this. And she really, you know, therapists are supposed to push buttons, and she kept pushing the same button. And finally one time she pushed it that last time, and it was the only time I'd ever really gotten angry at my therapist. And I said, you know, all right, let's talk about it. You know, let's talk about it. But what you don't seem to understand is this is going to freaking, you know, this is going to ruin my life. You know, I have a wife, I have a kid, I have a dog, I have a life, and this is not going to fit into my life. You know, this is going to screw up my life. And she said, well, your death is going to screw up your life. And she was convinced that if I don't deal with this, I'm going to go back to drinking alcoholically, and I'm probably going to die. So I brought it home to my wife, and I told her. I was in tears, and soon after she was too. And I said, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I have to do something, because this is real. Whatever it is, and I didn't know what it was, this is it. This is the main event, because every time I think about it, I begin to cry. Every time I talk about it, I get emotional. There must be something to it, or it wouldn't be causing me this much pain. And I don't want to talk about it. And we went on to do all kinds of conversations one after another, and you'll get into that when you ask me other questions. But the bottom line is that this was not necessarily good news for me at that time, and it certainly wasn't good news for her. This was a game changer for our life together, possibly a game changer for our marriage, and it scared me to death. The idea that this could be it. This could be the real deal. This could be the truth. Mm-hmm. I guess I hope that's a little bit of a tangent, but that's how it all happened.
And I think that's a perfect tangent. That's a perfect thing to talk about that we sometimes don't get to cover on here, is the fact that, yeah, that moment where we realize we're trans, that's a terrifying moment. That's one of those where, especially when it's someone outside presenting it to you like that, in a way, you know, you're not at a level where you're accepting it yet and comfortable with it. You're just sort of slapped with it. And it's like, you knew that you were hiding something, that you were holding on to something, but you didn't know what it was. And the way you'd gotten by was to ignore it and to push it down. What were the next steps with your therapist after that?
Therapy began to be, it was all tied up together with alcoholism. And, you know, in my program, I began to tell the truth. See, I was going to therapy for years before any of this, and I was lying to my therapist. I was lying to her about whether I was drinking or not. And I was wasting both of our time, but I knew I had a problem. I came from a drug and alcohol program, which I volunteered to be in. It wasn't court ordered, or I wasn't in any trouble. But my wife thought that I needed something more. I had had 10 years of sobriety, and I relapsed, and I couldn't stop drinking. My intention was to stop for a little while and see if I really was an alcoholic. And if it didn't work out, I could just come back. It was a miscalculation on my part, because I just couldn't come back. I couldn't stop drinking. And I took it to the gates of hell. I almost died. And the fact that I'm actually sitting here talking to you is a miracle all by itself. But the reason I was in therapy was because I needed to do something in addition to what I had done already. And so I'm in therapy now. I continue to have the same therapist. She's probably listening tonight. And the next steps were one painful conversation after another. They were normally conversations about what to do with my home life. Week after week after week, we were talking about my relationship with my wife and how hard this has been, and one painful conversation after another. I used to joke with her. I said, you know, like I cry more than we talk. I mean, this doesn't seem like therapy at all. I actually asked her one day, I said, when is it going to get easier? And she said, it'll get easier when it gets easier, which is not what I wanted to hear. I wanted some kind of a concrete time frame on this because I was tired of being in pain. And when you uncover something that deep that has roots all the way back to age 11 or earlier, it doesn't come without pain. It doesn't come without a lot of anguish. At some point I began on hormones and you know, estrogen has this funny thing about, you know, stirring up the emotions too. So crying becomes a lot easier. But so I would say the things that we did in therapy were hard. They were conversations about home life and what to do with my wife who was really struggling. And everything was about her because I was terrified of losing my relationship. My wife and I have been married for 30 years. And, you know, that's a very long time. And we're each other's best friend. We love each other. She's my, you know, she's my partner for life. And when I say that this is a game changer, I wasn't just saying that. This is something in Jennifer Boylan's book, she talks about it too. She said, you know, there were times when did not know like how thin the ice was, did not know for sure whether we were going to make it or not. And I did not know for sure whether we were going to make it or not. It's one day at a time, one painful conversation after another, and one article of clothing after another. You know, like I would put on something new and she would be frustrated with me that I would just go and do something. And then we're all, you know, the family's all supposed to just pretend that you're not wearing a dress now. You know, and it was, I didn't jump right into a dress. I wore a black shirt that happened to come from the ladies section of the store. And it didn't even look like a lady's shirt, but I was terrified that she would notice it. And so it was one small incremental change after another. And some of them would generate conversations. And then I would have to run to my therapist and say, you know, my wife is really, really upset with me and I don't know what to do about it. And the ice being as thin as it was from the very beginning was terrifying to me because I don't think I could, I don't do well alone. And I hadn't been without my wife somewhere in my life for 30 years. I couldn't imagine a life without her. So that was what my conversations were mostly about. They weren't about me, they were about my relationship. And actually that was something my therapist suggested at one point was, if it doesn't work out, as earth shattering as that may or may not seem, she said, imagine a relationship that did work out where you were with somebody who, you know, perhaps loved what you looked like. And I never thought about it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not good with change. And it's kind of funny that I'm in transition because it's kind of all about change. And maybe I'm my own worst enemy when it comes to this stuff. It might be that because of who I am and how afraid I am of change is what's making my transition harder than it otherwise would be.
What were some of the key things that you did in those conversations? Those things that you talked through that laid the foundation for you to be able to move through this together?
First of all, the foundation of every conversation has to be honesty and, you know, transparency. And my wife will probably disagree with this. And she's probably not wrong, but my recollection is that I tried to be as honest as I know how to be. I know that there were many times when I would hide things like lies of omission because as we began to talk about stuff, you know, it began to be more and more real. Like maybe this isn't a phase, and maybe being transgender really is who I am. And as it became clearer and clearer, each conversation harder than the last one, I saw the damage that I was doing to my relationship every time we had one of these essentially heart-to-heart talks. You know, they were painful for both of us. There was anger and frustration on both sides. And I would omit things because I just thought it was too much for us to go through. You know, like maybe we could discuss this another time, you know. And then she would find out about it some other way. And then she would say, you know, all your other friends know about this. I'm the only one who doesn't know. I feel like a fool, you know. And once again, she wasn't wrong. But sometimes I would omit things that I should have said, I should have talked about, I should have been honest about. And it always caused more trouble than it was worth. So it is very, very important, even if it hurts, to be honest. Even if honesty, you know, does some damage, in the end, it's going to come out anyway. So there's that. And so as far as the content goes, I mean, it began with, you know, I said somebody at one of my meetings told me, you know, maybe what you are is two-spirited. Do you know that Native American thing where you could have like both genders in one body and, you know, your spirits are two-spirited? And I said, yeah, maybe that's what it is. And I ran home to my wife and I said, I think maybe I'm two-spirited. And you could see like the relief on her face. I remember thinking maybe it's possible that this is what it could be. And we could live with that. But a week later, I went back to my meeting and I talked to the woman and I said, you know, maybe I am two-spirited, but if I am, they're both female. because nothing has changed. I feel the way I feel. And in fact, the more I talk about it, the worse it gets. It's almost as if once your egg cracks, it's like, you know, not only is it impossible to put it back together, but I just don't want to, you know, like I just didn't want to go back. And it was the same with hormones. When I started taking them, I told my therapist, I was afraid that once I begin, I was going to like it too much and I wouldn't want to go back. I was going to do microdose so that it didn't affect my body too much. And maybe I could get away with it. And, you know, like, definitely walking around with breasts was going to affect my marriage. And in the end, I did like it too much. I was right. The more I became, the more I wanted to become more. And so in conversations with her, it was one incrementally difficult conversation after another. And I have to say that I'm not the only one in transition. The people that love you, that are close to you, are also in transition. They might be a couple steps behind you. They might not be right where you are at, but they're beginning to understand a part of you that may take some time, just like it took me time. So, you know, when Venus the other day was talking about having her relationship, you know, where you'd go a little too far and then it'd be too much. And then you'd have to like back up a little bit and say, all right, maybe that's going too fast. You know, I'm okay with that. Let's back up a little bit. And so we would. But then, you know, a week later I'd try it again. You know, I'd be like, okay, so I really want to wear nail polish. I really do. How is it going to be possible for me to do that where it doesn't make you too uncomfortable? And all of that stuff, I don't know what to say. I don't even know why it's okay now and it wasn't then, other than time and a little bit of patience and a lot of love. I mean, my wife and I love each other very much. And even though our relationship has changed quite a bit, you know, that part is still the same.
One of the things that you mentioned there that I wanted to bring up was the fact that you mentioned there's no going back, that like it's, when you think about it, it's not possible to go back. And that's one of the things that I've found through my transition is one of the single biggest things for fighting dysphoria. It's that moment when I try and think about, well, what if I tried to go back? What if, you know, just forget all this and just go back to being who we were before? And it's like, that will shock you. That'll hit you and you go, that doesn't make any sense. There's nothing about that makes any sense. And that just sort of recenters me and makes me realize, okay, no, I'm doing the right thing. It might not feel great today. There might be something going on, but it's clearly better than the life that we had before.
Going back isn't possible because it doesn't exist anymore. You know, like, it's only in my memory that it exists. There is no back. It's just now, you know, and whatever happens in the future. And even that is out of my purview of control also. But there were moments. The going back idea kept coming up because I remember waking up in the middle of the night, laying next to my wife, and I would think to myself, what am I going to do? You know, like, are you, you know, like, I understand where I'm at. I know who I am. I know that I'm transgender now. But what am I going to do? Like, I had to do something. And that was when the idea of like going back, like maybe it's all been just a big mistake. Go upstairs, talk to my wife, tell her, you know, I've changed my mind. I'm burning the clothes. I'm putting away the makeup. I'm going to grow a beard. It's all going to be fine again. And she's going to be she's going to be in love with me again, the way I look at least. And it's all going to be fine. Well, even if I could do that, which I don't think I can, I don't think that would work anyway, because once she's seen me this way and she's seen how happy I am, it's really hard to imagine me being any other way. Like she loves me and she's been able to see that I'm happy, you know, like I am euphorically happy. I didn't even know what that was until recently. I didn't know how miserable I have been for almost 60 years. I was skipping across the parking lot one day and I swear to God, I was skipping. I had the nicest shoes on that I've ever worn in my life. I really looked pretty, and I was skipping across the parking lot, and I looked over at my friend who I was with. I said, "What's going on? I don't understand this feeling." And she said, "Well, I don't really know either, but I think maybe what it is that you're happy, and you've never been that way before, and you're unfamiliar with that feeling." So going back is dark, and there's nothing good back there. Mm-hmm. Got to go forward, even when it's scary.
Has this, as a whole, coming out as trans, has this improved your relationship?
Over the last several months, it was like a switch went off. I don't know whether it was, I'm gathering or guessing that it's just acceptance. I am transgender, and this is who I am. And let's try to work with it. I guess maybe that's what it's been. Again, I refer to Jennifer's book. There's a place in the book where there's an afterword by her wife, and she's talking about Jennifer being annoyingly happy, like just euphorically happy. Meanwhile, she's the one who's got to hold down the fort and take care of the kids and, you know, the nitty-gritties of life. And Jennifer's just like wildly happy, and for her, for her wife anyway, it's nothing about this that's good news, you know. All of my options sucked, and I think my wife actually said that one time. She was like, "What am I supposed to do? You know, what am I supposed to do? That our relationship has improved immensely. I will say that we're going out to gallery shows. She's doing the most amazing artwork. She's an artist, and she's been able to retire and concentrate exclusively on her artwork. I am in transition. I'm also a writer, so I've been able to do a lot of my writing. And, you know, I'm in this amazing job that I can't even begin to tell you how cool it is to come to work and you know, talk about recovery 24 hours a day instead of just at meetings. It's, you know, I am incredibly happy. And I think that when you're near somebody who's happy, sometimes you get happy too. I like to think that's what's happening. I don't know. I take it a day at a time. My love for her has not changed at all. But I know our relationship has changed, you know, especially the physical part of it. There are things that I miss. You know, I miss the hugging. You know, I miss touching. And I know that she does too. I said one day, you know, to her, you must really be lonely, you know, because I know that there are times when I feel that way. And she said, I am. I'm very lonely. So I get choked up talking about it, but there are some things that we're still working on. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of history together. We're each other's best friend. She had a scary dream the other night, and she had to call somebody. And it wasn't lost on me that even in her dream, she called me, you know. We are fully engaged in each other's lives. So maybe that's what makes it even harder. If we hated each other, it'd be easier to just say goodbye and have it be over. Mm-hmm. That's not where I want it to go. And I don't think she does either, but we're free spirits and we get to be happy. Whatever that means. And I don't know where it's all going to end up. Only God knows that. And, my God isn't telling me anything.
I wanted to switch tracks a little bit here. You mentioned in your bio that you're a Native American woman, and you mentioned the two-spirit identity, and then the fact that both of those spirits would be female, if that's the truth. What is your relationship with your Native American heritage? How closely knit are you with that community?
Not as much as I would like. I was born on a reservation in South Dakota. I was adopted when I was 2 years old and moved off of the reservation before I have any memory or recollection of it. My adopted parents told me at an early enough age that I was adopted. It went in one ear and out the other, and yeah, so what? And I, you know, resumed my life. It was never something I thought much about until much later in life. And, you know, eventually what happened was my wife wanted my son to have some heritage and some lineage. And even though we were separated at the time, having a very rough patch, which I didn't talk about, we have been through rough patches in the past. This isn't the only time. And it's interesting to notate that that rough patch was not unlike the rough patches we've had recently. It had to do with alcohol, and it had to do with cross-dressing. And in the middle of one of those rough patches, she went out to South Dakota and found my mother, which is a little bit absurdly hard to hard to figure out how she managed to find my mother, but she did. And she found she found out that I had a sister, full-blooded sister. And, she went as far as she could without my permission. She needed my permission to get more information. And we wound up going out a second time, with my son, and we met my mother. We met my father. We met my full-blooded sister. And it was interesting when I went to the reservation, and walked down the road on, you know, in South Dakota. I saw the Black Hills all around us. It was as if I was home. It was a pretty powerful moment. I remembered. Some part of me remembered, which makes me think that there really is something to this spirit idea that your spirit inhabits bodies, and I've often wondered if my spirit used to inhabit a number of other females, and that's why it feels so strange when it's inhabiting a male body, now, but yeah, the relationship is struggling because she did give me up for adoption, and even though she's tried to make amends to me, and you know she gave me a blanket, and in her own way she told me she did what she thought was right. She probably saved my life because men on the reservation do not do well. There's a lot of alcoholism and a lot of danger and death. Murders and suicides, and it's not a great place to grow up. So she might have saved my life, but at the same time, in the back of my mind, it's like my mother gave me up, you know. It's hard. And I think, you know, some part of me has this complex where, you know, like when I was a teenager growing up into my 20s, I didn't want to be alone, you know, and I would be with girlfriends just because they were girls and just because they liked me. Those were really my only two requirements. And and because I didn't want to be alone, you know, and sometimes being alone is better than being with somebody that, you know, isn't good for you. So the abandonment thing has been a huge, huge part of my story. And you know, my sense is that I don't do well by myself. I really do like being in a relationship, where there's love and, you know, where there's a home, you know, my wife makes our house into a home. And I get to live here. If you experience that, you never want to lose it. I think it's like the most important thing there is.
There were two things from that story that I wanted to dive into a little bit deeper. We'll get to the second one, which is, you know, have you been able to develop a relationship with your biological family since that time? But first I wanted to ask, you know, you mentioned struggling with the idea of the fact that your mother gave you up. Is it made worse? Is it made more difficult by the fact that that you have a full-blooded sister that is still with your biological parents?
Not really. It's interesting though because she grew up on the reservation. She speaks Lakota. Mm. She looks like my father, and I look more like my mother. It's an interesting thing, but. You know, there's a part of me that, you know, sees her as, you know, as what I might look like if I had been born a cisgender woman. So it's kind of cool to see the female version of me. And I don't know. The only thing that I can tell you is that I have a fair amount of guilt and shame. For not being better, you know, in touch with them, having reacquainted myself with, you know, my actual birth mother and birth family, you would think that I'd be on the phone on a regular basis and try to stay in touch. And for a while I did, but then life got busy and then I started drinking again and I don't know. It fell by the wayside, and now I've gotten out of the habit of being in touch, and I think we speak maybe once or twice a year, and I feel badly about that. I really do, but you know where I'm from, as far as my birth parents, is not nearly as important to me as my adoptive parents. Those are the people that raised me. Mm-hmm. And those are the people that gave me all of the things I have, including, sad to say, my shame and my my guilt. And some of the things that I still carry today, I got from the adults in the 70s. I got some stuff that I don't have to carry anymore, but sometimes you put stuff down and it winds up picking back up again. I a lot of my story has to do with the adults in my life and how there was a time. You have to go back a long time ago, like to when I was 5, 6, 7 years old, climbing trees in the woods. You have to go back a long time before you can find that young, innocent, pretty cool kid that hadn't gotten screwed up yet by by notions of, what I should and shouldn't be, what I should and shouldn't do. And, the feelings that I had were real. And I was basically told, straighten up and fly right. There's something wrong with you. And I took that to heart. And I said, they must be right. They're the adults. They know, maybe I am a weirdo. And I've been carrying some of that stuff into adult life. And I joined the military. I became a bulldozer operator trying to cure myself because bulldozers seem like a macho way to go. And if I could drive a large machine, maybe I could cure myself of wanting to wear frilly things. I could tell you it didn't work. It backfired because in the military, the best bulldozer operator turned out to be a female cadet. So it didn't work out at all. But this whole notion of the parents know better, the adults know what they're doing, even to this day, I am haunted by some of that stuff. There's a song by Tom Petty called Running Down a Dream. And there's a part of it where the lyrics are, there's something good waiting down this road and I'm picking up whatever's mine. And I add to the end of that song and I say, and I'm dropping what isn't. And I'm not going to carry that. Oh, I get choked up. I'm not going to carry that stuff anymore. Right. It wasn't true then and it's not true now. And I get to put it down. But like I just said, sometimes things don't stay down. They come back and haunt you some more. So this is, like you said in the beginning, this is not a straight line. Being transgender, there's like, it's crooked. And you take 3 steps forward and then 2 back and then you make a left and that doesn't work. So then you make a right. And it's like trial and error, trying to find your way through to the end of the path, wherever this path's going. And it's been, other trans people can vouch for it, and I know you can too. It's really hard. It just is. But it's so worth it. Like, I can't remember who said it, but I think it was, I can't think of her name off the cuff, but somebody that you interviewed said, why are transgender people, after they throw so much at us, why are we still so happy? And, of course the answer is because we get to do this. Like how cool is that? And I think you said, well, maybe it's because other people don't get to do that. Maybe they're a little jealous of us. And your guest said, yeah, but why can't they? Like everybody's got their own truth. Everybody's got their own, like finding themselves. And why can't they? My truth happens to be transgender, but another person's identity might be something else, mm-hmm. And exploring and going down the road to actuality. This is really who I am. It's very exciting stuff. I mean, it's the most amazing life story I've ever done, and I've done it all in the last 2 years. So that part of it is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. You know, finally making progress after zero forward motion for 40 years. Here we are. We're like all of a sudden making some progress.
Is there anything you feel you've been able to accomplish because of your journey?
My number one accomplishment is what I've decided to devote the rest of my life to. And that is because I am so open about it, because I've come out full time, I can be helpful to somebody else who is struggling. And I don't think that you can be as helpful if you're not willing to go there first. Some of the hardest things that I've done, I have done without instructions. You know, there are times when I've done things, and like my friend Jessica, the Jessica, the one with the K, she's the only one who's been there maybe that I've been able to talk to. But largely, I'm on my own. And you actually said it in the pre-interview. Some of this stuff we have to do by ourselves, and there are no directions, and there is what other people have tried before, but it's not exactly what we're doing. It might be a little like what we're doing. Each of us has our own story and has to lead our own life. And sometimes you really are up there on stage doing it by yourself for maybe the first time. That's what's called life. Like, you actually have to step up to the plate and take a swing. Nobody can do it for you. You know, I think it's Brené Brown that talks about being out on the field performing. And it's really easy for people up on the cheap seats, you know, to be pointing fingers and laughing as you fall. And you're not going to, it's not if you fall, it's like when you're going to fall. We all fall sometimes. And when I fall flat on my face, and they're up there in the cheap seats laughing at me, I pick myself up, I dust myself off, and I remember, guess what? I'm the one down here doing this stuff, and I'm taking the chances, and I am the one who has the courage to do it anyway, even though I might get laughed at. I was in a biker bar the other day. It wasn't really a biker bar. It was more like a construction worker biker bar. It was a scary bar. And there was a bunch of people there, and they didn't disappoint me. All of them pointed and laughed and talked and you know, like, I got everything that I thought I might get and more. And I thought to myself as I sat in my car after, you know, it took me a little longer to get my food on purpose, because I said, you know what? You're not going to chase me out of here. You know, I'm allowed to be here too. And, but I sat in my car and I thought to myself, you know, I'm kind of happy with the direction of my life. Basically, what it comes down to is, I am making my way. Sometimes I'm alone. Sometimes I'm with others, but I am out here doing it. And maybe that's the accomplishment. Maybe it means that others get to watch, and maybe their lives get a little bit easier too. You know, I don't know. I have no control over any of that. All I can do is hope. And that's another thing too, is I have hope for the future, not just my own, but for those others who are struggling, mm-hmm. and for our world. I think it's largely less dangerous, even though lately it's gotten a little worse, but I believe the kids are taking over and making a better world for us, and they are our future. So yeah, thanks.
What would you say is your favorite thing throughout your journey that you've learned, either about yourself or the world around you?
I learned that it's possible. You know, like, I know Jessica mentioned Reddit. I used to be on Reddit too, and I watched people transitioning, and I saw before and after pictures, and I thought, you know what? You know, their pictures don't look any better than mine. Maybe it is possible. You know, like, maybe transition is something that I could go through. And not only that, but it's not just the physical part of transition. Maybe it's possible that I could find happiness where there was none, you know, because other people have done it too. So I think that the happiest thing about transitioning is finding that there is light at the end of the tunnel. And that, you know, we concentrate a lot on the downside, the dark side, mm-hmm. how difficult it is, how frustrating it is to be laughed at, how transition sucks. But we all go through it and we do get to the other side. And when I see other people who have made it, and like I look at them and I think nobody would ever think of them as anything other than who they are. And maybe someday I get to Home Depot and I stop getting misgendered. You know, maybe someday I get to be myself and the whole world, you know, sees me as who I see myself as. And maybe I can move on and just live my life. You know, I don't want to be a transgender writer necessarily. I just want to be a writer. And it would be nice to get to that place, but I'm not there yet.
And finally, for this section, what advice do you have to pass on to young or closeted trans folks out there?
It is scary. You know, if you choose to stay in the closet, so what? There's a lot of reasons why you might do so. But I will tell you that for me, I couldn't. It got to a place where I just couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't keep it under wraps. And when I tried, it just kept like bubbling over. So I didn't really have a choice. I had to come out. And so coming out of the closet was the beginning. It's not the end, just the beginning. And as scary as it is, at least for me in my experience, I don't think there's anything more gratifying, more euphorically happy, and more worth it. I don't think there's been anything in my life that can even compare to it. It's the most amazing thing that's ever happened to me. Coming out is about dropping the mask and being you to the world for the first time, maybe ever. And that's why I think coming out of the closet is so scary, because maybe you've never been your true self, you know, maybe ever, you know. It's it's pretty earth shattering, really.
Well, Tony Leslie, thank you so much for coming on the Transgender Show. It's been wonderful talking to you and diving into your story.
Yeah, likewise. I it was just a pleasure to be here, and I have wanted so much to meet you. So it's been an honor. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Transgender Show from the Transverse Network. Watch this show live Tuesday nights at twitch.tv/thetransverse and later on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/thetransverse. Follow Tony on Instagram at Tony_Leslie2009. If you love what we're doing and want to help support the Transverse and get access to exclusive content, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/thetransverse.